It's my first opportunity today to meet both our guests in this session. Ed Young, who's next to me, former speechwriter, David Cameron, who's also written, we're just discussing the roles he's had, a number of books with Douglas Hurd. I've got one of them here to wave about for you, Choose Your Weapons, The British Foreign Secretary, 200 Years of Argument, Success and Failure. That's a long title there, Ed.
Well, yes.
Yeah. And next to Ed, we have Michael Cockerell. How do I introduce Michael Cockerell? He is the Dean of Political Documentaries in the United Kingdom and has been for quite some time. Nobody knows how he gets the access he gets. It probably takes a negotiation as long as agreeing a new nuclear submarine, but he gets there. He gets right in, and sometimes if you saw Inside the Commons, his 2015 documentary Behind the Scenes in the House of Commons, he even got along the ankles of the MPs behind the... what, we never got there before, did we? I mean, incredible. So let's welcome Michael and Ed to our conversation. Welcome to both of you. Yes. Oh, they're applauding. Well, if you're applauding, we're done. That's great. You wanted to break in straight away, did you?
Well, can I have a word about
Please
a literary
do.
Partnership,
oh, right,
which I think is an important to be clear about the nature of a literary partnership.
Yes.
Douglas,
did I overstate your place?
Only a little bit. But Douglas Hurd and I, Michael came to our very first book launch in 2007. We did a joint biography of Peel, Robert Peel, and it was my first job in life to be the researcher to this book. And Douglas had written me a letter, which carried a quote from Disraeli. Disraeli, full of amazing quotes, but he had said, the problem people have in life is that when they're old, they no longer have any energy, but when they're young, they don't have any experience. So Douglas and I had this argument that we could solve this. I would provide the experience and he would provide the energy. And the result was we produced these three books, which were great fun to do.
But, you're very good at mimicking Douglas Hurd's voice actually.
Yes.
Give us a bit more of that.
I think that's the limit, really. But no, it's great to do. So we did this book about foreign secretaries. Were many of you here yesterday at the session on Castlereagh? So we did this book about foreign secretaries, which began with Castlereagh and Canning fighting this duel 200 years ago on Putney Heath, September the 21st, 1809. And it's an amazing encounter that two colleagues in government decided that they were so angry with one another that they would go and try to kill each other on Putney Heath.
Yeah.
But out of that firefight, we discovered a genuinely sophisticated argument about the best way to run foreign policy. And it took us through 11 foreign secretaries from the start of the 19th century until just after the war. And you discover this pattern, different relationships, different characters, and the fundamental thing which runs through all of these extraordinary lives and careers is that every foreign secretary takes a view at the heart of the way they run their foreign policy based on what they think about human nature. And this is, it comes back again and again. Do you basically think people are good? Do you basically think people are there to be trusted?
Mm.
And it runs all the way through, and people wrestled with it in different ways. People took extreme arguments, thought that war should never happen under any circumstances. So it was great fun to do. And it was great to be here yesterday at Castlereagh's home to talk about it.
So, it's a great venue for it, isn't it, for that conversation?
Location, yeah.
Can you imagine if we transposed the Putney Heath solution to Brexit?
Yes,
what we could have done.
Yes. I don't think it was that far off
no,
at times.
No, it got pretty close, didn't it? Can I start on this conversation about the Foreign Office? And you've gotten into the Foreign Office, part of your great series, Michael, going behind some of the great offices of state. Is the Foreign Secretary gig as good as it once was, in political terms, in terms of the ambition of a politician?
That's a very good question. Could I say, first of all, William, thank you for the obituary when you announced me. It's like being
the first
in my
line
coffin
of your obituary.
And
Michael Cockerell was the
here.
Dean of Political Biography.
Thank you so much. But it's interesting, your book, Ed, stops just after the Second World War, and I've been looking at foreign secretaries since the Second World War. And a number of things struck me about it in terms of what the gig is worth and what it's like. That there have been 15 different foreign secretaries since the war, and five of them went on to become prime minister, which is quite interesting. Although, interestingly, a number of those five also were chancellors. So five chancellors also went on to become prime minister. Only three Home Secretaries ever went on to become Prime Minister after the war. The latest is one we know.
It's a graveyard. It's a graveyard shift.
And the first one, of course, was Home Secretary before the First World War, Churchill. Mm. And the only other one was Jim Callaghan, who held all three great offices, so in some ways he doesn't count. So there have been the five foreign secretaries who've become prime minister, three in a row in the 50s and early 60s, three old Etonians in a row, Anthony Eden, followed by Harold Macmillan, followed by Lord Hume, Alec Douglas Hume, and then no one till Jim Callaghan, and then the one that most people would probably forget, John Major, who was Foreign Secretary for about 5 minutes, I think. And then Mrs. Thatcher had a crisis, and John Major was appointed Chancellor after Nigel Lawson.
He was the last one standing around.
That's right. And indeed, when he first became Foreign Secretary, he walked into Number 10 and Charles Powell said to him, "What's the capital of Bolivia?" And he said, "I'm not answering that kind of question."
The pub quiz question is.
But
good, yes.
The other side of foreign secretaries since the war is how many of them, for how many of them, it's ended in tears. The Palace of Dreams has ended in tears. I make it about 9 out of 15. Sewan Lloyd was effectively sacked after the series. Patrick Gordon Walker, Harold Wilson appointed him Foreign Secretary in 1964, but he failed to win election to his seat, and he stood again in a by-election which Wilson created, and he lost the by-election in one of the safest seats in London. Then George Brown, who famously became tired and emotional, which is a private eye euphemism for being one over the eight. Tony Crossland, poor old Tony Crossland, died in office at a very young age. Lord Carrington resigned because of the Falklands invasion. Francis Pym, she didn't like Francis Pym, she thought he was wet. And she sacked him the first time she had the chance after the 83 election. Geoffrey Howe famously resigned, and we know what happened there. Robin Cook was sacked by Tony Blair, and Jack Straw, to his great surprise, was sacked by Tony Blair. So a lot of them, it ends in tears. It's not necessarily the route to the top.
Do you have the impression, Ed, that some politicians start out in life wanting to be foreign secretary? That's the dream gig?
Well, as Michael said, the role and the significance of the role has changed. So when Castlereagh got the job in the 19th century, he didn't take it that seriously. The key was to be leader of the House. That was the most important job. What's changed over the last 200 years is the role of the Chancellor. So the Chancellor has grown steadily in significance and become the key job. In those days, in Castlereagh's days, he wasn't interested in being Chancellor. Nobody really wanted that job. Disraeli, when he was given the job, didn't know anything about it, argued that he couldn't count. And Darby, the Prime Minister at the time, turned to him and said, "It's all right, Disraeli. They give you the figures." and so you get the sense that this role was not very significant. But the role changed. The role changed. I think the role of the Foreign Secretary has a natural romance, which remains. I don't know if you agree. I feel that there is something about the sphere and the scope of that work that is different to any other job in government. And the characters who have taken on the role, on the whole, have had a thirst for doing that kind of work, which is different. And I think you see that again and again. Anthony Eden is the classic. He considered a job actually as a diplomat, going into the Foreign Office, didn't do it, but throughout his political career, his total focus was on building a reputation in international politics and international relations. And that you see again and again with various individuals. I think there is something different about it. I think that will always remain. I think you have intellectually, it gives you a broader sweep. You can think about big challenges, fundamental challenges. It's quite a philosophical job in some ways, as well as being very practical. So there are different ingredients to it. Some people like the element of prestige. Mm. So there are aspects of that job that will always be different and attract people to it. But in terms of its actual significance, it's certainly less than it once was.
Well, we're going to be talking about the current incumbent. I'm not going to mention the name of the current incumbent because things go crazily strange all of a sudden once you mention his name. So we'll get to that eventually. And we'll talk about
and
how
we'll see something
yes.
about the nature of the
once
job.
Once we mention the name,
that whoever
that's
he
the
is.
Only thing we're going to talk about, right? So we'll pause before we mention the name and how the office is changing with Brexit and what's happening right now. But we also want to show off the BBC archive, of course, because we've got some wonderful films, many of them from you, Michael, which have taken us inside the Foreign Office. Introduce this first clip for us.
Yes, and it's absolutely related to what Edward has been saying in terms of the nature of the role of the Foreign Office and the Foreign Secretary compared to previous decades and centuries. It's in the old days, often a Prime Minister was also Foreign Secretary, so he could do both jobs. And built into the job of Foreign Secretary is that key relationship with Number 10 Downing Street. And there have been many clashes over the years that have gone on as the Prime Minister of the day seeks to second guess or even overtake and replace the Foreign Secretary. And who knows what might happen with the person whose name should not be mentioned for the moment, because the current Prime Minister of the female variety, like Mrs. Thatcher, has become Prime Minister without any background at all in foreign affairs as such. So this is a clip from the film I made called The Palace of Dreams in the Great Offices of State.
Right. The absolutely key relationship for the Foreign Office is with the Prime Minister of the day. The Foreign Office looms physically over 10 Downing Street. But prime ministers often want to be their own foreign secretaries and cut a dash on the world stage. This has led to a number of battles royal, with Number 10 often accusing the Foreign Office of being temperamentally inclined to kowtow to foreigners.
The toughest negotiations any foreign secretary has are always with his own prime minister. For the foreign secretary to be effective, he has to have the backing of the prime minister and his cabinet colleagues. Otherwise, he's ineffective. And the worst thing any foreign secretary can do, really, is say to his other colleagues, well, of course, I agree with you, but she, meaning Mrs. Thatcher, won't, or alternatively, some other prime minister won't. I mean, that's the worst thing you can do.
When Margaret Thatcher came to office, in her early days, like most prime ministers, she said she would concentrate her energies on the home front. The Foreign Office had no idea what was about to hit them.
She didn't like the Foreign Office at all. Famously, she said, we have a Department of Agriculture to look after farmers, we have a Department of Defence to look after the soldiers, and we've got the Foreign Office to look after the foreigners.
Mrs. Thatcher quickly began to relish her role on the world stage and liked to quote the line that when it came to standing up for British interests, the Foreign Office was just a hotbed of cold feet.
The Foreign Office thought I didn't have much skill at diplomacy. Certainly diplomacy wasn't my forte. It was the policy that was right for Britain, which was my forte. And certainly I spoke with a directness, a truth and a strength to which they were not used. And they might even, some of them, have been shocked. After all, their whole culture was not sense of purpose, sense of direction. It was compromise. It was negotiation. It was diplomacy.
Compromise was a dirty word in Mrs. Thatcher's political lexicon. She felt that because we spent so long studying foreigners and learning their languages and living in their countries, that from time to time we forgot who paid us and where our interests were.
She used to hate that expression, let's find a form of words, Prime Minister. That sort of implied to her write it, papering over differences and distinctions and trying to obscure concessions. No, she wanted it black and white, and she liked to confront people and issues very directly.
Tensions between Prime Minister and Foreign Minister are not unknown. They're almost bound to develop with the passage of time as Prime Ministers become more confident of their own view and more experienced in the world they're trying to deal with. And it becomes all the more important for Prime Minister and Foreign Minister to retain a close working relationship, to hammer out such differences in advance rather than in public or in mid-flight.
We've achieved that because we've been able during the two terms in office to move Britain from the sidelines to the centre of the European community.
And Mrs. Thatcher's relationship with her Foreign Secretary grew steadily worse over the years.
I think they were a rather effective duo in a way, provided neither tried to play the other's role. Trouble is, of course, both of them often wanted to play the other's role as well. I used to sit there in their bilateral meetings, which the Foreign Secretary and Prime Minister had once a week if they were both in London. I used to feel I was almost like a marriage counsellor, seeing this relationship breaking down and being helpless to do much about it.
She said of you that he fell into the habit that the Foreign Office seems to cultivate of subordinating national interest to negotiating tactics. In the end, his vision became finding a form of words.
Yes, a grotesque parody and a remarkable insight into her own lack of insight.
A grotesque... She talked about your insatiable appetite for compromise, and that would sometimes lead her to lash out at you in front of others.
Yes, well, that's certainly right. But one could hardly accuse Margaret Thatcher of having an insatiable appetite for compromise. It needed someone around to moderate that lack of effort after compromise.
Good.
Gosh.
That's very good.
Oh.
There you saw the tensions, absolute tensions between a prime minister.
When diplomats get round to insults, they really know how to do it.
They
don't
do it,
they?
Don't they? Absolutely.
That's stinging stuff, Ed, isn't it?
The role has changed because of summits. You had a session earlier about summits, and so that puts the prime minister in a natural position of prominence that possibly wasn't the case 20, 30, 40, 50 years ago. So there is something has naturally changed. And then the second element is geography. So Castlereagh, when we talked about him yesterday, there was an amazing letter that Lord Liverpool wrote. This is right after the Napoleonic Wars, as he's wrestling to get peace in Europe. And Lord Liverpool wrote him a letter, Prime Minister to Foreign Secretary, "It would be very helpful if we could see your treaty in Cabinet before it is finally approved, open brackets, to guard against minor errors." You couldn't imagine Margaret having written that to any of her foreign secretaries. So geography is part of it. And I think the third thing is something about... I'm struggling. It's not vanity, but there is something about once you get to that position. Neville Chamberlain had this as well. Because so much of the skills that have got you into the role of Prime Minister have been around your ability to persuade and charm, you think there is a read across from that to foreign policy. Neville Chamberlain was the classic for this. He thought that if you just spent time, take it away from the Foreign Office, stop Anthony Eden wasting time, put me in front of Mussolini, put me in front of Hitler, and I can do business with them, and I will carry peace in Europe. And I think that there is something that will always be inherited in that role, about once you get to becoming Prime Minister, you will always think that you have the ability somehow to produce a better outcome than your Foreign Secretary would.
Cameron didn't seem to be at war with his Foreign Secretary.
No, I think that's right. He was helped greatly by Ed Llewellyn, who was my boss, who was Dave's Chief of Staff. And Ed had worked for a long time in foreign policy in one form or another. And he was the crucial bridge. And so there was never a need, really, as far as I saw, for Dave to feel that foreign policy was moving in a direction that he wasn't comfortable with. I think even that said, you know, the events that took place, the Arab Spring, Syria, that again will always put the Prime Minister into a position where they will feel the need to act
and drive
it. Exactly. Yeah. And the natural drama of events, that is something that every Prime Minister will always want to respond to. I saw it when I first joined when Russia invaded Georgia. Again, that's the same pressure just to respond. So it will always be there, but that's right. The last PM had an exceptionally good and constructive relationship with his foreign secretary.
You almost get the impression, Michael, that when there's a change of leadership in Downing Street, the Foreign Office is waiting for the email to discover what their purpose is now, because it kind of changes depending on how the Prime Minister sees that Department of State.
Yes, I think that's true. And we might, just before we go to contemporary, just go back to Tony Blair and this crucial figure that has been in with successive foreign secretaries, who comes from the Powell family. You saw Charles Powell, who said that he had to play the role of marriage guidance counsellor. His brother, Jonathan, when almost by some kind of hereditary succession, when Tony Blair became Prime Minister, his brother Jonathan then worked doing exactly the same job for Tony Blair. And we'll go in a second into a clip about it, but it seemed to me that in the unwritten British constitution, there had to be a Powell behind the throne. So if you run the clip.
Let's see that clip.
Technically, Jonathan Powell was recruited by another destiny Prime Minister and was the Powell behind the throne throughout Tony Blair's years in Number 10.
Like most Prime Ministers, when Tony Blair came to office, as when Thatcher came to office, they were basically interested in domestic policy rather than foreign policy. So when they get into the job and they realise what they've got to do in terms of foreign policy, how much of the responsibility lies on them, that's when they get fascinated by it.
And were you aware of how the Foreign Office saw Tony Blair in terms of what was said to be a marginalising of the Foreign Office because he would take over foreign policy himself?
Well, yes, of course. I came from the Foreign Office, so I knew precisely what they thought when my brother was there, and they felt that Thatcher had been marginalising the Foreign Office and foreign policy. And then I knew what they thought when we were there, and they thought the same thing. There's always a sense in the Foreign Office that Number 10 is trying to trump them, trying to run foreign policy, and it should really be left to them. But for the Prime Minister, it is somehow easier to make things happen in foreign policy. You can, by saying something or doing something, change things in a way that takes a much longer time in domestic policy. If you're changing health or education, there's a long, hard grind to make things change. Foreign policy, by attending a conference, agreeing a EU budget, or whatever it is, you can make a bold stroke much more easily.
Or, he might have added, start a war much more easily.
Start a war, yeah. Mm. Yeah. Did you detect in that answer a sense that the Foreign Office has a little institutional paranoia?
Well, I think the thing is, you have to remember the context. My literary partner, after he being Foreign Secretary, there was a huge outcry against the nature of British foreign policy. Robin Cook had come in and promised what it was called an ethical foreign policy. Wasn't entirely clear what that meant, but an ethical foreign policy. And something fundamentally was seen to have broken in that the Foreign Office and the way it worked for the world was not equipped to deal with humanitarian disaster, wars within countries, people killing their own people. And so I think part of what happened after 1997, particularly in the run-up to Kosovo, was that Tony Blair and Powell took policy in a different direction in order to change the way the Foreign Office worked. There was a great speech Blair gave in Chicago in 1999, one of the great speeches that he ever gave, which set out a completely new way of thinking about foreign policy, where there was, in effect, a right to intervene in certain circumstances. Mm. The issue was that the argument got blown into the trees when it came to Iraq, because he used those rules to apply to something that probably it shouldn't have done. Mm. But I think that you have to remember that the Foreign Office at that time was discredited, fundamentally discredited. And so there was a deliberate shift. You could see why they did it. And then over time, it has balanced out. I mean, I think there will always be a sense of frustration from officials that prime ministers who aren't necessarily completely on top of the facts are fiddling with things they don't really know anything about. But I think that there was a circumstance in that situation which, to some extent, made it understandable.
I mean, you're right about that Chicago speech. It sort of changed what had been the doctrine that you don't intervene in the internal affairs of another country unless it's a direct attack on your own interests.
The UN Charter law, isn't it?
Yeah, exactly. and he redefined it. And and I think that one of the key moments for Tony Blair, as far as that was concerned, was when he went to the immigration camps in Kosovo. And the Kosovans were so pleased to see him, and they were all shouting, "Tony, Tony, Tony, NATO, NATO, NATO." And in the refugee camps, 9 months later, many of the children born in the refugee camps were christened Tony or NATO, and some of them were actually christened Tony NATO. I think it sort of went to his head. He got a sort of messianic complex, which when he met George W. Bush, who had a messianic complex from the other side, they saw eye to eye over Iraq.
The other thing I would add is that you, in foreign policy, you're always taking views about what to do based on history. And people have history books that are too thin. They're always judging policy by their most recent experience or the most recent sort of disaster. So Anthony Eden went wrong over the Suez Canal because he thought Nasser was another Hitler. And I think what happened a lot with that period after the 1990s, after 2001, was that Blair did something similar. He looked at history in a confined way. You have to have history never gives you the answer, but it gives you a playbook to think about. And he never fully analyzed in depth the parallels. What is the right parallel? Is there a parallel to the experience that you're having at the moment? It becomes very easy to say it's another Hitler or appeasement doesn't work. Mm. Truths that may or may not actually be applicable in any given circumstance. And I think that's a crucial thing. He kept on talking about history. There's a sort of, you know, the weight of history is on our shoulders.
And presumably that's one of the roles of the Foreign Office, as, you know, a custodian of history, to actually remind the Prime Minister, we've kind of been here before. You weren't born at the time, but we've been here before. This is what happened the last time we saw this.
Yes, that is absolutely the role of the Foreign Secretary and of the Foreign Office to do that. But your problem is, if you have a politician who has this sense of destiny, a destiny politician, you could see it 100% in those clips of Mrs. Thatcher. I'd forgotten what a wonderful performer she is. You know, I could watch those clips forever. Yeah. It was amazing.
She could have hidden the contempt a little bit more.
I love that line that she used about the Foreign Office. That,
that
it's a hot bed of cold feet. It's such a brilliant line.
But she could herself be charmed, couldn't she? Douglas has a story of her refusing to see a Spanish minister for months on end, and eventually got her to go and see her. And afterwards, during the course of the meeting, the Spanish minister tapped her on her arm, interrupted her, dangerous thing to do, interrupted Margaret Thatcher and said, "Madam, I have been warned in advance of your intellect, but no one warned me of your beauty." And afterwards, Douglas, this may be apocryphal, but the story is Douglas then left the room and, why didn't you introduce me to him earlier? What a charming man.
See, a story like that, which Lord Carrington told me, was when she first met the then Chinese Prime Minister, and she asked him a question in Downing Street, about how he saw the current relationship between China and the United Kingdom. And he talked with an interpreter without a break for half an hour in an answer to the question. And Carrington slipped a note to Mrs. T, which said, "Prime Minister, you're talking too much." And she nearly got a fit of the giggles in front of the Chinese.
Oh, dear.
All right, that moment has come.
Oh, good.
Boris, there, I've said it.
You've said it, absolutely. I was talking to one of the distinguished former Foreign Office officials who are here in this august house, and I said, what do you see as the prime requirement for any foreign secretary? And this distinguished former official said to me, "Integrity." It's an interesting word. So we come to Boris Johnson. And I've made a number of films about Boris Johnson.
You certainly have.
And I've thought a few clips just to show the background and his possible qualifications for the great job of Her Majesty's Secretary of State for Foreign and Commonwealth Affairs, which came as a great shock to many people, not least to Boris himself. So Let me start with a clip from one of his nearest and dearest, who's also here, Rachel Johnson.
It's up incredibly early, and then he will run, and then I'll have breakfast, and I'll write a speech, and I'll go to work. I mean, he's already done a full day's work by 8 o'clock.
Because there is this extraordinary sort of contrast between that sort of drivenness and how he seems to look as if he's a shambles.
Yeah, it's very, very clever. Yeah.
Boris isn't pretending to be chaotic. He really is utterly chaotic. And getting Boris to do his expenses or to fill in pieces of paper or sign forms is an almost impossible task. He's always been like that. And in a way, it's a form of... It's unusual. He's got discipline when he wants to have it, when he thinks something's important enough, that if it's something that is going to seriously promote his interests, Boris will be there at the right time on the right day.
He's a sly fox disguised as a teddy bear. He's very clever and he's very likable.
So that last one was, of course, Conrad Black, yes. Who was the owner of the Daily Telegraph.
Quite an endorsement.
A sly fox disguised as a teddy bear. And, yeah. And before that was Max Hastings, who was Boris's editor at the Daily Telegraph, where Boris was a journalist at the Daily Telegraph. So we can move swiftly on to the next clip, where Max tells us about how he chose Boris to be his man in Brussels.
She aggressive original in Brussels to really get onto the whole EU issue, which was then really becoming very big stuff in British politics. And we just looked around for our brightest and available young man, and Boris looked like it, and he did not disappoint our hopes.
Oui, je crois que les Français a réussi avec une fantastique embuscade avec cette histoire de la monnaie unique avant 99. C'est un complot français.
The multilingual Johnson became a Eurosceptic reporter. He ridiculed the Brussels Commission with his gift for a phrase and his nose for a good story. From Euro manure to one-size-fits-all condoms, little escaped Johnson's eye.
A number of the EU correspondents I've talked to said that you would take stories with a grain of truth and then hype it up and hype it up almost beyond recognition.
Well, I mean, you know, I think there's a bit of pots and kettles going on there. Yes, there were one or two stories which perhaps, in retrospect, either because you'd slightly miscued the story yourself or because it got souped up in some way in its projection and, you know, the thing was a little bit over-egged or whatever. I think I once said that the Berlaymont was going to be blown up, which didn't turn out to be quite true.
The Berlaymont, the headquarters of the Brussels Commission, is still standing. But Johnson's growing Euroscepticism would help shape his own political future.
So there you saw something of Boris's formation and the start of the many hostages to fortune he has given over the years in terms of insulting many of the heads of state and heads of government around the world, including calling Hillary Clinton, she looks like a sadistic nurse in a mental hospital, that kind of thing.
Yes.
So it'd be nice when he meets.
Yeah.
President Clinton, if that's what she becomes. But the other side of it is this extraordinary appeal, public appeal, that Boris had developed over the years. Whenever you go and film with him, people are saying, hello, Boris, people of all kinds. Yes. And he does have this charisma, partly based, which you could see a bit there, and you'll see a little bit in this next clip, on his extraordinary sort of bumbling manner. Now, is he, we know that he was a classical scholar, he understands about history, he speaks ancient Latin, ancient Greek and Latin, as well as a number of other languages. He's extremely bright. When he was at Eton, he used to be in the school play, and He made a thing of not learning his lines in the school play, and the plays would turn into a sort of dialogue, hilarious dialogue, between him and the prompter. Oh, so what comes next? And I said to him, has that been a lesson for life, that you learn, you could get more laughs by not learning your lines than by learning them?
Yeah.
Mike, I don't know, but if you're saying, do I sometimes give the impression that I don't really know what's going on? Well, sometimes I don't really know what's going on, and it gives me more time to think. But even if I do know what's going on, it also gives me more time to think. So he sort of accepted this. Now, it'll be quite interesting. Yeah. Diplomacy is often a matter of the exact word, the exact verb. Yeah. There was a huge thing about in the United Nations over whether you put a "the" in the occupied territories or occupied territories, and they spent months arguing about that. So Boris has a gift of imprecision.
What conclusion did you come to? Is it strategic shambles?
Yes.
You think so?
Yeah. I think he's very bright and he knows what he's doing, but he is also something of a shambles. I mean, a friend of mine went to do an interview with him some years ago, and arrived at his house, and Boris was going up north for some trip, and arrived at his house about 20 minutes before the train went from Liverpool Street. And Boris's first was, "Oh God, can you help me? I can't find my trousers." So he looked around the house for Boris's trousers. And so they set off with the taxi, get to Liverpool Street, and Boris goes, "Oh, cripes, where's the piece? We should be at King's Cross." And they missed the train. So there's something of Boris which there is a shambolic nature. Although, you know, Max said if it's in his interest, then he gets there booted and suited on time. Let me show you one clip before we go into
his
qualifications for the job. He became this extraordinary famous figure, especially once he hosted, effectively, as Mayor of London, the Olympics. And we showed him some clips of the crowds in Hyde Park as he launched the Olympics, shouting, "Boris, Boris, Boris." And he said, "It's very dangerous, you know. You can see why Roman emperors had these bread and circus." "Great. It's a wonderful feeling when they were shouting, Boris, Boris, Boris." I said, "Would you like to be a Roman emperor?" He said, "A lot of them came to a sticky end." And that's the cue for the next clip.
He'd fly through the air with the greatest of ease, a daring young man on the flying trapeze. His movements were graceful, for girls he could please, and my love...
A sticky end was the mot juste for Johnson's celebrated trip, which climaxed with the daring young mare stuck on the zip wire.
"I want you to know, it's going well, it's very, very well organised. Get me a ladder."
"I want you to know that that was far more painful and frightening than you might think."
"In what way?"
"Because it was, to start with, it was jolly high up. And after you stuck up there for a while, stuff starts to chafe and so on and so forth."
"Well, around your groin?"
I don't want to go into these details, Michael. I mean, it was chafing was involved, but..."
"I thought you wrote in your book..."
"Did I? Right.
The I'm only quoting you, Boris. This is what's so difficult. I quote you.
I can never remember what I've written. Okay.
You said it got very, very tight around your groin area."
"Did it? Right. Well, if that's why I wrote in my book, it must be absolutely correct."
"If any other politician anywhere in the world got stuck on a zip wire, it would be, you know, disastrous. For Boris, it'll be an absolute triumph. He defies all forms of gravity."
His Olympotastic performance enhanced his image as a political celebrity.
"He defies all political gravity." Did you write that line? That is a great line. You must have written that line.
The paradox of this man is, you sort of said it before, by every normal standard of political success, he should have failed, right? He breaks every rule, every possible rule, right? So says things he shouldn't say, rickety headlines, odd things going on elsewhere, has all kinds of disasters lettered behind him, and yet he soars past it. I actually don't almost think they are hostages to fortune. I think they're, paradoxically, they're helpful to his own fortune because he breaks the mold. He's like,
Are we all deliberately avoiding the Trump analogy here?
Well, steady on. Let's begin with another analogy. We wrote a book about Disraeli, and actually the better parallel is Disraeli, who was exactly the same. So started off as a journalist, wrote things he probably regrets writing, had all kinds of issues going on elsewhere, series of disastrous encounters, and consistently said things that he shouldn't have said that were thrown back at him, and yet he soared past it. And what Disraeli discovered that I think Boris also has is that. In an age where pomposity is treated as a virtue, having imagination and humour, and someone who very clearly, every time he speaks, tries to be at his very best, is a game-changing thing. I think what you got is, when I was in politics, we used to talk about trust in politics. I actually think it's cynicism. I fundamentally don't think that people, the public, go to sleep at night thinking that we are run by a class of crooks. We're clearly not. What we are run by is a class of very banal members of parliament who've got used to going on television and not saying anything that breaks the party line, right? So and you get this slightly damning experience of listening to the Today programme in the morning and hearing very intelligent people operating at the bottom of their abilities. And the charm and the power of Boris is that he clearly doesn't do that. And he will cope with the fact that there may cause some problems down the road, but he will never say something unless actually he thinks he's proud of what he's about to say. It might be completely wrong, but at least he's adding imagination to politics.
Gosh, you make him sound like a foreign secretary for our time.
Well, I think then you get into a different area. Then there's the question, the skills required to be a foreign secretary, I think, are slightly different.
So we move on to... To take this story to today, there are a couple of clips just which I think will set it up nicely. Of course, it came to the moment when Boris had to decide which side he would be on in the referendum campaign, because the Boris effect is such that if he were pro staying in, that could have swung 2% or more of the votes, and it was only won by this narrow majority. And David Cameron desperately wanted Boris to be on the staying at the Remain side. And Boris, with his European background, he very sharp-eyed viewers will have noticed when he was speaking in French, he was speaking in Belgian French, where he said non-ont instead of 18 for 80 or 90. 18. Oh, these
Brussels French,
non. His father had worked for the Commission and he'd gone to school in Brussels. Mm-hmm. So he has this great dilemma as to what he's going to do in the referendum. So we can run this next clip if we.
Should I stay or should I go?
David Cameron admires Boris Johnson's charisma, and he desperately wanted Bojo on his side in the referendum campaign. But Johnson wouldn't make up his mind.
Should I stay or should I go?
In February, he drove to his Bolt Hall in Oxfordshire, having said he was genuinely conflicted on whether or not to go for Brexit, and was veering all over the place like a supermarket trolley. Johnson was being offered a top cabinet job by Cameron if he joined the Remain campaign. He decided he would use his weekly Daily Telegraph column, for which he's paid $250,000 a year, to help reach his decision. I've been told by someone in a position to know that you wrote two articles for the Daily Telegraph, because you knew you had to have an article in the Daily Telegraph on the Monday. One was for staying in, the other was for getting out. And the person who told me this said that the one for staying in was the more persuasive.
Well, on the contrary, the one, I don't know what your conceivable sources for that information may be, but I can tell you seriously that I decided that he was much better for our country to go out.
This person said that your arguments for staying in were stronger than the arguments for coming out.
Perhaps, I don't know.
But you did write the two articles.
I certainly, what I can say is that I wrote...
There's a way of helping you make up your mind.
And I'll tell you what the second article said. What it said was that actually, irrespective of my objections to the way the EU was going, in order to support my party and the Prime Minister, it would be better to stay in. And I thought, in the end, that wasn't a good enough reason.
Now, let me say about Boris, I have huge respect for Boris as a politician. He's a great friend of mine. He is a fantastic mayor of London. I think he's got a lot to give to the Conservative Party. I think he's got a lot to give to this country. But on this issue, I think he's got it wrong. And I think he's reached the wrong conclusion. So we're going to have, I hope, a very reasonable and civilised argument.
It was the latest contest in a relationship between the two men who'd been friends and rivals for nearly 40 years.
Well, I think that was clear confirmation of the two articles at least, wasn't it? I mean, his first response was to immediately confirm and then change mid-sentence before, yes. But then he came right around to confirming that he'd written two pieces.
Yes, exactly. Yeah, it's an extraordinary story, and the whole referendum campaign was extraordinary from that point of view. And in terms of, maybe you're in a better position to say it than me, Ed, in terms of what David Cameron's view of Boris was as far as where he would be on the referendum and how he reacted to Boris's decision.
The parallel I think on this is, now this is a hostage to fortune. The parallel I see in Boris Johnson is he's like Churchill in the 30s, where he took decisions on things that were probably wrong and he regretted. So Churchill in the 30s, took the wrong view on abdication, he took the wrong view on the India Bill, but he was right in the end about appeasement. And I think Boris is quite similar. I think he once he forms a view, it isn't necessarily the view that will help him in the long run, but it will be there and it will hang around his neck. And I think that's what's happened in this situation. I think Boris will recover from whatever went on, and he certainly will, because his ability is so clearly there. But I think it's a very similar man in some ways, that he's absolutely, once the decision is taken, it's held to at all costs. I never found in all my encounters actually that there was any deep antipathy. I found, as a speechwriter, I found I had to work harder on the speeches when the two men were side by side for my boss. But I wouldn't go any further than that. I never found any deep sort of dislike. It was always, on the whole, good-spirited. This isn't quite like Blount versus Blair in the last years. I never found that. I don't think it was right to push it down that path. But it certainly had a significant impact on the history of our country.
Yeah.
In the appointment of Boris Johnson to the Foreign Office, have they kind of filleted the Foreign Office so much that it's not really a Foreign Secretary role anymore, as we understood it previously?
Can I say a word about this from a sort of a historical context? Yeah. Ernest Bevin, right? Great man, Ernest Bevin. Yeah. Trade union warrior, extraordinary man in the Second World War, became Foreign Secretary, and the Foreign Office were in uproar. What on earth to do with this man? Ernest Bevin used to take his false teeth out in the middle of meetings as a sort of diplomatic trick. He would deliberately mispronounce the names of his interlocutor. He refused to call Molotov Molotov. He called him Maulatov. And so he used to open discussions at diplomatic meetings by introducing his doctor, Ernest Bevin, overweight, dying. He used to introduce his doctor to everyone around him by saying, this is my doctor, John, and he treats my behind like a dartboard. And so just to be clear, and this is an important context for the conversation we're about to have, there is an asset in diplomacy to being slightly idiosyncratic, put it that way. So sure. I think the Foreign Office can cope, is my view.
Yeah.
What are they coping with?
Ernie Bevin also said, talking about his red boxes, whenever you open this red box, you never know what...
what's going to come out.
I mean, no, it's more than that. It's the...
I'll come
I've
back
got
to
the book
it.
Here.
You've got the man.
But I think that's there is a parallel there. There is a parallel. Yeah. And Bevan did it. But Bevan was, you know, he was a great man in many ways. But the machinery of the Foreign Office was confused, baffled by this man who came in. A very delicate time in British history.
So do you, by that analogy...
What, when you open this Pandora's box, what flock of Trojan horses are going to come
out. It was absolutely amazing.
So by the analogy, though, with Bevan, do you mean the Foreign Office is struggling a bit to know what to
I just mean that the analysis which is always applied, that... What you want in the Foreign Secretary is a calm, steady pair of hands. I don't think is necessary.
William Hague.
I think you get different. Yes. You get different models of being Foreign Secretary.
How do you think the Foreign Office is coping with them?
Well, in the session we had yesterday, we had the wonderful quote from Sir Robin Rennick, or Lord Rennick, who was our ambassador in Washington and various other places, and he said the Foreign Office regards every new Foreign Secretary rather like an oyster regards intrusion of a grain of sand.
That's a great quote.
Likely to prove an irritant and highly unlikely to provide anything of lasting value. I don't think they're necessary, but I think that there's that sense that the foreign, the diplomats who've been there for so long think that they can house train a foreign secretary, especially if it's a kind of maverick foreign secretary like George Brown in the Labour government of the 60s. Mm. But Boris would be quite difficult to house train. I'll show you one clip of him as Foreign Secretary within a few days of becoming Foreign Secretary. You might like this clip.
Today, he's Foreign Secretary, sitting alongside global statesmen. But for many years, Boris Johnson was a journalist, one who'd been rude about many leaders around the world.
Good afternoon, everybody.
And at his first news conference in his new role, some of that past invective came back to haunt him.
You've accused the current U.S. President Barack Obama of harboring a part Kenyan's, quote, ancestral dislike for the British Empire. You've described a possible future U.S. President Hillary Clinton as someone with, quote, dyed blonde hair and pouty lips and a steely blue stare, like a sadistic nurse in a mental hospital. You've also likened her to Lady Macbeth.
Mr. Johnson hit back, insisting his words had been taken out of context.
There is such a rich thesaurus now of things that I've said that have been, one way or another, through what alchemy I do not know, somehow misconstrued, that it would really take me too long to engage in a full global itinerary of apology to all concerned.
But still the questions kept coming.
You have an unusually long history of wild exaggerations and, frankly, outright lies.
Ouch. Just look at how uncomfortable that made the U.S. Secretary of State, who went out of his way to praise his new colleague.
This man is a very smart and capable man. That's the Boris Johnson
that
I have met. And that's the Boris Johnson that I intend to work with, and we intend to make good things happen together.
Stop that. That's fine. That's great. Thank you.
It's called diplomacy.
That's fantastic. It's going well. It's going well, John. Thank you very much.
Well, yeah, but you forgive him, don't you? Because it's so charming, it's so lovely, and so unusual. You know, he's not a stuffed shirt behind that lectern.
No, and that was Boris at his best, and John Kerry, it's called diplomacy. If only John Kerry were the Democratic nominee or even the Republican nominee for president. That whole kind of confidence and style and... gravelly, grey voice, just what we want. Boris, I mean, Boris, interestingly, suddenly, you know, out of the ashes of his leadership campaign when he was stabbed in the back and front by his friend Michael Gove, and he was really down, and it was an extraordinary thing. Yet suddenly, a few days later, he gets called to one of the great offices of state. Talk about the ups and downs of politics. Yeah. A friend of mine was at an event when those results, Mrs. May's cabinet reshuffle were announced, and it was a sort of private dining club in Westminster where there were
certain commentators and politicians, including Gove, and the NITA, her choosing the next cabinet. And as one, they all buzzed as their vibrators, their mobile phones went off, and it said Philip Hammond, Chancellor. Everyone knew that. And then about 10 minutes later, it said Boris Johnson, Foreign Secretary. And my friend was looking at Michael Gove as he looked on his mobile phone, and he went sheet white. He'd seen the ghost of Banquo. It was extraordinary.
How do you explain it, Ed?
Well, I was just going to say, I think the bigger question is actually the institutional question.
Yeah.
You've now got three people doing foreign policy.
Absolutely.
You've filleted part of that department. That's your issue. Yeah, that's the fundamental challenge, not the personalities.
Just to stay with this, do you think that Theresa May had to appoint Boris to one of the three Brexit-like departments, foreign, international trade, or the department for leaving? He had to go to one of them.
No, I don't think so. I don't think it was inevitable, no. I don't think so. I think... She's come in at a time of extraordinary confusion, particularly within the Conservative Party, and I think it is significantly helpful to her to have him inside the government. Equally, the role of Foreign Secretary, as we know and as we've been talking about all day, is a role which actually is one stage removed from the immediacies of everyday politics in the UK. Now, I think there is a question...
She wanted him on... planes out of
the
country.
No, it's more that the 8 a.m. meeting, right, when they go through what is in the headlines of the day, actually, on the whole, foreign policy won't be there. Brexit will be, but foreign policy won't necessarily be. And I think that just shifts it a little bit.
Was she setting him up to fail?
No, I don't think so. No, I really don't think so. I don't.
I think one of the reasons she chose him was more that her own image as, you know, the very safe pair of hands, the totally predictable, to choose Boris, you know, without a doubt, in many ways, for some of the reasons you were talking about, you know, one of the most talented politicians we have, certainly the most sort of well-known and remarkable and original, even just the way he talked at that press conference, to put him in the Foreign Office and to say, look, you made the choice about where you would stand on the referendum, to put him in this extraordinary new setup of the three Brexiteers. Three of them who don't always get on totally well, but all three of them have quite strong personalities, and how this will work institutionally within the Foreign Office, and how they will work as a team is going to be absolutely fascinating.
Can we have a word about Europe in general? I mean, the interesting debate of the role of the Foreign Secretary is, we are an island, or a set of islands, 20 miles off the coast of France. And the debate about the right relationship with Europe is not a new one. It has gone on and on and on and on. And what you see when you look at Castlereagh and Canning back after the Napoleonic Wars, Austen Chamberlain after the First World War, Anthony Eden and Bevan after the Second World War, is you wrestle. You are consistently presented with a choice of how you interact with this extraordinary block of countries that's caused enormous concern for our country for centuries, and almost half your trade is with it. That is the fundamental question that never goes away. And the choices you make in the end as to how you deal with it are about your character and about the judgments you make from your own experiences in life. And I think that's the interesting thing. And the point that Michael was making by sharing that time that Boris had in Brussels is fascinating, because you have a hinterland. This is a man who was there, who saw Brussels at its most confused and bureaucratic. And that influference will always be there. That is a very profound shaping experience.
And also invented some of it.
Absolutely. Yeah.
Quite a lot of it, apparently.
The story. He certainly hyped some of them. But the point was that when he was there, unlike almost every other correspondent in Brussels, who were all kind of Europhiles, Remainers, he was a skeptic. And so he was writing these stories against the grain of what all the other Brussels correspondents were doing, and was cordially hated by most of the correspondents, because they would get calls at 3 o'clock in the morning from their news editors saying the Berlinmoor's going to be blown up. Yeah. So they weren't very pleased about that.
Why didn't you bring the banana story? I'm still not understanding the reasoning, the rationale behind the appointment of Boris Johnson to the Foreign Office specifically, and why you think that happened. I sense from what you were saying, Michael, that Theresa May wanted to keep the charm and the colourfulness of Boris Johnson front and centre, and certainly if he'd gone to the International Trade Department or somewhere like that, we might not hear from Boris for months on end. And is that the reason, some of the theatre of Boris she wanted to keep out there? Because I have heard some people saying, by putting him into this position, she's setting him up for a fall. Those moments, we're going to see more of those moments with John Kerry.
I don't think any Prime Minister ever does that. They do sometimes send dangerous people. They use it to send someone effectively into internal exile, but that's exactly not what she's doing with it. I think, interestingly, he had his lines open to Theresa May while he was still standing as a candidate, and she sent him a text immediately after Gove had knifed him in the back and saying how sorry she was. So he'd already got his lines open. And quite interesting, she hadn't got the same sort of past history that she had with Michael Gove, with Boris. Yeah. She had a little bit of it when, during the Brixton, the riots in South London, Brixton, and when she came down in 2011 to try and sort of calm things down, and she was doing. Then suddenly, Boris turns up with a broom, and so all the press just go from one to another as he says, "We're going to sweep up." Sweep up the mess, and she knew how he could upstage her, but I don't think she bore a grudge on that.
What we've not talked about today is prestige, and a lot of foreign policy, this phrase that my co-author thinks he invented, but Geoffrey Howe thinks he invented, which is that Britain punches above its weight in the world, and there's this great literary debate who invented this phrase, but this phrase is an important point, right? A lot of foreign policy is prestige. A lot of it is actually your ability to be recognised, and this, you know, people took it too far. Disraeli thought prestige was a solid asset, something you could count, but there is an element of foreign policy which is simply your ability to be heard and be recognised, and all the clips you've shown earlier show that this man is exceptionally good at this, and so it's a great strength. He will help project a Britain, a vision of Britain. It might not always be coherent, but it'll be a vision of Britain internationally, which will be heard. And I think that surely is helpful.
Come to you in a second for some questions from our audience. What do you think the Foreign Office's role and the Foreign Secretary's role will be in this Brexit?
You tell me. I don't know. This is my big question.
Key roles have been sent somewhere else.
I think that's the confusion. I really think that is a fundamental confusion. I can't see who does what between those three roles. I find that.
What are you hearing from the Foreign Office friends that you have? Are they equally confused about what their role might be?
They are a bit. They sort of wish that Prime Minister was still running, because they have a thing where Sir Humphrey goes and said, "But Prime Minister, I'm not sure about Brexit, how this is going to work."
Yeah.
And she says, "Sir Humphrey, Brexit is Brexit." And Sir Humphrey says, "Yes, Prime Minister." And they like this tautology. David Cameron used to use it when Boris got into one of his scrapes, and he'd say,
Boris is Boris.
Yes, Tony Blair used that when, do you remember John Prescott in 2001 punched a voter?
Yes.
John will be John. It's a good way of doing it, but it doesn't tell us what's going on next. And I think we're living in a fool's paradise at the moment in terms of the real complexities and the implications of what it will mean. You know, 40 years of our history and the entanglement of almost every institution in Britain with Europe. And I don't see the intellectual thinking from the three Brexiteers or even from the Foreign Office yet, which defines quite where we're going to go, nor from Mrs. May herself.
The audience, you're absolutely sure in your mind, Ed, that we are talking about three Brexiteers rather than two and a half.
They're all connected. I don't see how you disengage them. I think any question that arises in the dealings of Britain with the outside world has now got three people who think they can answer it.
Yep.
I can't see another way.
Good luck with that. Let's go to you with some questions. We've got some mics moving around the room. We've got a couple of minutes, 10 minutes, I think, right at the back. Hands up and we'll come to you very, very quickly.
Thank you for wonderful insights. May I ask, who do you think was or is the best Foreign Secretary we never had?
We never had.
Apart from John Major's maybe premature exposure for 5 minutes.
Well, Dennis Healy always thought that he was the best Foreign Secretary we never had. Because Dennis was, you know, in terms of these kind of colourful politicians, yeah, yeah. You know, he had the word he invented to describe a sort of multidimensional. Yes, he had a hinterland. Yeah. You know, he'd been a beach master at Anzio for the Lanis. He loved. Yeah. He was a painter, a photographer, and a poet and a writer. And you know, he was an extraordinary figure. And he was shadow foreign secretary for a lot of the time. And people think he was foreign secretary, but he never was.
Yeah. I think the greatest foreign secretary we never had was Disraeli. Because if you read the Disraeli quotes, his view of the world, Disraeli genuinely believed that the world was divided into a world of empires run by princesses, priests, and secret societies. And the things he wrote about the way the world worked are absolutely amazing, absolutely hilarious. And you think, you know, that interaction is funny. Imagine Disraeli on a pedestal,
yes,
but with the Tsar. Who he, you know, abused 2 days earlier in an article. It's absolutely amazing. I think that would have been a cracking experience to witness.
The Illuminati type of
absolutely, yeah,
stuff.
Yeah, yeah. And Disraeli had a very odd view about religion. So Disraeli, Jewish, but baptized a Christian. He genuinely thought, he was a racialist, so he thought that the world was organized by specific racial hierarchies. But he consistently insisted on talking about this. So, you know, for example, he thought that Arabs were only Jews on horseback. He used to say this again and again. Arabs, they're only Jews on horseback. God never spoke to a European, so why should I? I mean, you know, you know, you can imagine this is the kind of stuff that we've been here. We'd have dined out on for weeks.
And you think that makes him the best
foreign
secretary?
I think it would have been.
Would have been entertaining.
I think it would have. Exactly.
From a journalistic point of view, he's the best we never had. I think somebody else in the middle. Yes, let's get a mic to you in the middle, and then we'll come to this lady at the front. Yeah, go ahead.
With Boris Johnson being as charming as he is disarming, and as compelling as he is confounding. I would feel quite sorry for the respective legal teams where any agreement was having to be drawn up by those countries. They could be travelling in parallel paths and think they've all reached a different agreement. How would that be resolved? Or do you think that's always going to be Boris Johnson's get-out clause, that he's been misinterpreted?
Yes.
He did use it. I noticed that. He used that phrase a number of times, taken out of context. Misconstrued, I think, you know, like construing a classical translation. I think this will be one of the interesting challenges when the words of the agreements that are reached will have to be absolutely precisely agreed. And Boris will be able to talk his way out of it, but his legal teams will have to work very closely with him to make sure that's what we're saying, Boris.
Yes? Put your hand up. Sorry, this lady here. I think someone at the back over there had a hand. No, maybe not. Okay.
I actually think Boris could be our secret weapon.
Yeah.
A very clever choice. Theresa May can do her normal, calm self. They don't really know whether he's going to eavesdrop, interpret. Our competitors around Europe have got a big trouble on their hands, I think.
I mean, it's a sensible point, isn't it, about his personality. Exactly. People might open up to him in a way that they might not to a traditionally stiff British Foreign Secretary.
I mean, he's a very forthright man, and I think when push comes to shove, he will actually show his intelligence. Hmm. I can't say I'm politically motivated in.
Are you his aunt, by the way? I'm just checking. Are you his aunt? And I've got a sister here. Are you not? You're not relation or anything to Boris?
Oh no.
Just checking.
I think right.
Can't you see? I mean,
no, that's
actually,
right.
Donald Trump.
You're Donald Trump's hair.
I think he'll certainly be a weapon. How secret a weapon, I think, is an open question.
Good luck keeping that a secret.
We talked earlier about the point about the appearance of confusion and disorganisation. I strongly think that is a huge asset, because you can imagine the situation. You're going to go into a slightly complex technical briefing on agricultural subsidies, and your interlocutor will think that you're dealing with someone who doesn't really have any clue what's going on, but actually this super sharp brain is active behind the scenes. I think that is clearly helpful. I really do think that's
helpful. Sometimes he doesn't have a clue what's going on.
I wonder whether that really
I also think in terms of that relationship with a prime minister, there have often been very good relationships between prime ministers and their foreign secretary, where they and one plays the hard cop and one plays the soft cop. One is the humorous one and the other is the straight man. I think he and Theresa could be a formidable double act. They won't really go to council of ministers meetings much anymore.
Clement Attlee used to say the point of having a foreign secretary is it's like having a dog, and if you don't let the dog bark, there's no point to it. And I would ask you all to consider that metaphor as you think about our future.
We can think what kind of sheepdog Boris might be.
You preempted my question. What type of dog?
I think he's the Dulux dog, isn't he?
What kind of dog is Boris?
He's a guy.
Go on, Ed.
It's Golden Labrador, really, isn't he?
Oh, yeah. Yes. Yeah. I'm going to have to bring this meeting to heel. Let's thank Ed and Michael. Haven't they been wonderful? They've been fabulous.
Thank you very much. Thank you.